Is idealism still alive on college campuses?
I think it is. I mean, these are times that are hard to have hope in some ways.
Idealism and realism on the college campuses of the 1990s on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. History has shown us that college campuses can be hotbeds of political activism. They can be the breeding ground for movements aimed at shaping both U.S. domestic and foreign policy. But what about the students of the 90s?
It's true that a lot of them weren't politically involved, but it wasn't that they didn't care, it was that they simply really didn't know how to act, had been taught not to act, were confused about how you take a stand in today's society.
That is author Paul Loeb. He's previously written about workers in the nuclear weapons plants of Hanford, Washington, in a book titled Nuclear Culture. He wrote another book called Hope in Hard Times, about the peace movement in the 1980s. Now he shares with us a new work, Generation at the Crossroads, Apathy and Action on the American Campus.
In fact, a good many students are involved in stuff that doesn't necessarily make the headlines, perhaps because it doesn't sort of correspond to our images from the 60s of 100,000 people gathered in a plaza. It may be more diffused. It's different issues. It's an environmental campaign here, work in a homeless shelter there. And so it's often been hard to track exactly what's going on. But I also think that there's a kind of cynicism in the media in general that has found it almost comforting to say, oh yeah, look at these, you know, they don't give a damn, and if the young don't give a damn, why should anybody else? And that part's been disturbing. And a lot of what I've done in the book, in Generation at the Crossroads, is to try and just question those myths about who they are, question the myths that they themselves responded to as they were growing up that kind of make it difficult for them to act. And to really, I mean, I spent 7 years on this project going all around the country, so really try and get in perspective the bind that they're facing, but also how they're beginning to overcome it in trying to act as citizens.
Why don't you tell us about the research that you conducted? How did you do this? I mean, how did you prepare for this book?
Basically, I've been lecturing on campuses since 1982, so I've been around, it's not totally strange turf for the colleges, but around the mid-80s, I got very concerned with the characterization. I remember the Alan Bloom book, Closing in the American Mind, came out, got a lot of play, and I just thought, this is so wrong, and not only is it wrong on specifics, like claiming blithely that no one got fired during McCarthyism, which was simply grossly false, but also just so insular, so little relationship to the students that I knew. And so what I decided to do is to go around. Sometimes I'd parlay it into the lecturing that I do at various colleges. Sometimes I would make a specific trip to a case where it would seem to illustrate some of the tensions. I went to look at farm activists and the student farm activists in Nebraska and how their peers were responding. I visited a tuition strike in City University of New York. I'd just been to a campus in Atlanta that had experienced a lot of racial tensions, and I went back to it for an extended stay. And so it was a combination, but always focused on watching and listening and trying to obviously bring my knowledge to bear, but not to let my own perceptions overwhelm the students and their realities. And I think I succeeded in that, actually.
The conventional wisdom says that students in the 90s will graduate with very high debt and very poor career opportunities.
It's true.
How does that affect their activism, though? How does that affect, you know, their mindset when they're on campus?
Well, it's hard. I mean, they are scrunched. There's no doubt about it. They're working many more hours of outside jobs compared to their counterparts of 30 years earlier. They're way further in debt, and will go further if some of the new proposals go through the Congress. And they're hitting an economy that's very uncertain, and where we've come to the point where the richest 1% now control just about as much wealth as everybody else combined. Now, how that affects their activism is complicated, because some people, in fact, are learning to act to challenge those issues. But for a lot of students, it puts them in a kind of bind where, well, I remember a student from Nebraska who was from a fifth-generation family farm background and was describing how much he loved working the land. He said, there's just nothing like it. You're out there, it's hard work, but there's the sun, the wind, and no one's looking over your shoulder. He said, it's a wonderful way of life. And then very sadly said, I'm afraid it's a dying way of life. The big agribusiness companies, the Dow Chemicals, the ConAgras, the Cargills, are just squeezing the small farmer out. And then I was very surprised. A short while later, I ran into him again and for our next interview. And he said, guess what, Paul? I'm very excited. I've got this great internship. And I said, oh, well, what is it? Well, it was with Dow Chemical. And my jaw dropped. I said, I don't understand. I thought you didn't like these guys. How can you go in and work for them after everything you've said? And very sadly, he said, well, I have to be realistic. At least they're in agriculture. Maybe I'll make a difference from within. And I think that there's a kind of resignation that a lot of the students feel. It was the same as this woman I met in Chicago who went on and on about how much she wanted to teach high school algebra and then said, but teachers don't get much respect and they don't get much pay, and she was going into marketing. So a separation from their dreams happens a lot, and that makes it difficult. There's also something that I call the perfect standard, which is it's almost as if they have to feel like they are ready to debate Kissinger on Nightline before they take a stand. And so whatever they know is not quite enough. And you learn something and you're still feeling inadequate. You learn something more and you're still feeling inadequate. And it's a way that I think our society has taught them to view what is necessary to act. In other words, the ones who do take a stand, they respond from stories, actually. They say, this person is homeless. I had to do something about it. A friend died of AIDS. I heard about a person, people being killed by death squads in El Salvador. And then they get the numbers later on. But the prevailing wisdom is almost that you have to be like the experts on TV. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have all the facts and numbers at your fingertips, then simply be silent. And I think that leads to some very dangerous consequences.
Yeah. You know, our program deals in international affairs. And one thing I thought was interesting in your book is that, I mean, you had students who told stories, at least, of being openly ridiculed for their interest in international events and U.S. involvement overseas. Tell us about that. So.
Well, I think what was interesting is that there was just a sort of sense that these are not affairs that we're supposed to deal with. That, I mean, it wasn't just that people would, if I asked them about, it was during the Gulf War, I remember asking about how many people knew about the U.S. overthrow of the Mossadegh government in the early 50s in Iran, which then installed the Shah, which then led to Khomeini, which then led to our backing Saddam Hussein as a you know, support against the Iranians, and then, you know, could argue led to the Gulf War. And no knowledge of that whatsoever. I mean, it's simply down the memory hole. And that was disturbing. But I think when people did act, they got called. I mean, I remember one guy at Dartmouth said, oh, yeah, he was talking about people who were involved in, I think, a walkathon to raise money in El Salvador. They're just marchers with their marcher face on. And they're just sort of dismissing him so blithely. Now, he did actually, after a while, sort of when we were talking, he said, you know, it is sort of odd that whatever cause people are talking about, whichever side they're on, we always figure that those of us on the sidelines know better than the people who are involved. But it took him a while to get to that point of questioning it. And I think that there was a sense that as soon as somebody speaks out, they become... Well, the phrase was, I'm not that kind of person. And that throughout Generation at the Crossroads, I heard that. I'm not that kind of person. Sometimes it was sort of with a little bit of respect. It's noble, but I'm not that kind of person. And then sometimes it was just, well, I wouldn't want to be that kind of person. And it's not going to look good on my resume. And it's going to damage my career. And why are they even interested in these things? I think a lot of insulation happens in our culture. I mean, there was a group of students I interviewed who... They used the phrase a lot, you make your own chances. And they kept repeating, and they were doctors and stockbrokers' sons, and I thought, very easy for them to say. And then at one point, a friend of theirs was more skeptical, and he said, well, it was a Catholic school in Connecticut. What about all that love thy neighbor stuff we read in the Bible? And don't we have a responsibility? And what about the town of Bridgeport, which was a very poor town nearby? And do we have a responsibility to those guys? And the student says, love thy neighbors? Bridgeport? Those guys aren't my neighbors. No way are they my neighbors. I live in Long Island. I know who my neighbors are. A kind of separation that simply, you know, severs you. And this is learned from the culture again.
You mentioned the Persian Gulf War, and that sort of took place while you were carrying out your research, didn't it?
It did indeed.
Yeah, what did you find? I mean, was there a lot of interest or not?
Yeah, actually, I mean, despite the sort of the severing of historical memory, it was astounding how much occurred. None of it made the headlines. I mean, not even the headlines. They didn't mean to make the back pages. That... given the brief duration of that war, and the overwhelming military success of it. I would question the political success a little bit more dubious, but there's a tremendous amount of opposition, a lot of which did happen on the campus. I mean, you would go to, you would see this huge encampment in the middle of winter at the University of Indiana, and thousands of them, literally 15,000 students and 10,000 students in the streets of Eugene, Oregon with tear gas. I mean, you think even something that fits the stereotypes of the 60s, the cops, the tear gas, that the media would have covered, but, no, they didn't cover it. And, I mean, every school I went, there were teach-ins, there were debates, there were, student government people arguing it out. And it was just so odd the way it was almost like it didn't exist. I remember being in Washington, D.C., and there was a demonstration of probably in the neighborhood of 250,000 people, a lot of whom were students. I mean, not half, but maybe a third of them were in that age group. It was a very significant contingent. And it got, I remember when the network news picked it up, I think it was NBC, they gave as much space visually to about 100 pro-war protesters. Now, had the pro-war folks turned out 250,000 people, it would have been perfectly legitimate to cover them. But really, to say 150 people in this case were equal to 250,000, what it did is that it made it very hard for Americans to recognize that, in fact, there was some legitimate dissent about that war and disagreement about whether it was wise or not, which had nothing to do with disliking the troops. A lot of the students, in fact, had friends over there. A lot of the ones who were involved, and they'd say, "Well, I'm doing this for my friend. He's over there. He's on the front lines," and yet it allowed them to sort of feel so isolated that then they felt, well, nobody obviously shares, look at the polls, nobody shares our sentiments, and feel overwhelmed. One of the interesting things vis-a-vis Vietnam is that there's an image that's sometimes hard for the students to get behind, where they romanticize the period and they say that was the time when everybody cared. And I remember noticing in one of the books I was reading that as late as 1966, at Madison, Wisconsin, which was one of the absolutely most activist radical schools in the country, 70% of the students supported the war. And so what that reminded me is that it took a tremendous amount of time for those challenges to really build. And when students, whatever they're involved in, it doesn't have to be foreign policy issues, when they feel isolated and alone as if nothing is going to happen, they're at nothing in comparison, they have to remember and they have to understand how difficult it was back then.
It's almost impossible to avoid talking about the 60s, and you do some in the book. I mean, what is the legacy of the 60s on today's college campus?
It plays out in different ways. And I mean, I thought about it a lot when I devoted a whole chapter and thought, was this just because this is the generation that I come out of that I'm interested in? No, it really does weigh on them. So it's several. One is the sense of romanticization. I wish I lived back then when everybody cared. And again, it's false because it underestimates how hard it was. And then if you realize that it was equally hard then as it is now, then maybe you feel a little bit more hopeful about what you can do now. Then the other way is a kind of a stigma. The phrase spitting on soldiers was thrown at me in all sorts of contexts. I mean, I could be talking about getting involved with homelessness or something. I mean, completely severed even from foreign policy. And people would say, well, I wouldn't want to be like those protesters who spat on the soldiers. And I would say, well, did you know a soldier who was spat on? And they would say, no, but that's what happened. I would say, how do you know? Well, I heard it somewhere. I'm not sure where. And I've had a couple of friends who tried to track it down because they were sociologists and they were getting it in their classes. And they couldn't. I mean, they just simply, they could not find an instance. They happened to work with vets groups. And basically their conclusion was, obviously in a country as large as this, probably it happened a few times. And Bob Green in the syndicated column threw out a call and, millions of people read it. A few people said, yeah, it happened. But the notion that it was remotely the centerpiece of the Times is a rewriting of history. Because in fact, certainly in my experience, everyone I knew in the anti-war movement was desperately trying to build bridges to the soldiers because they believed, which in fact turned out to be true, that their disaffection would finally force the end of the war, which is what happened. So it's a real deliberately rewriting history, because in that scenario of the soldier comes home beleaguered, tired, seeing people killed who he loves and cares for, and somebody spits at him, you obviously can identify with a soldier, and you're also going to be very harshly judging the person who was the protester. So it's important. The other thing that happens, I think, in the rewriting of history is there's a myth that says they all sold out, which the students, I got this a lot. How can you act as to act when look at the generation before us? They messed up the world and left it to us. They went all into greed and Wall Street and yuppieism. And what's interesting is that when, in fact, every tracking study that's been done of people from that era who are the most active, Berkeley, Florida, Michigan, the people who went south for the civil rights movement, has found significant continuities, has found people who were active then, still in some ways involved in their communities, even though lives have certainly gotten more complex, the times have changed, they can't necessarily act as they did back then, nor would necessarily want to. But it's not the notion of a betrayal. The folks who went to Wall Street, with a few exceptions, were not the people who were marching in the streets. And so it's very important for students to understand that, because otherwise it kind of breeds a cynicism. And it just sort of says, well, there's nothing you can do. Look at those folks. Why should I listen to anybody else? Hmm. So I try and make, you know, rebutting that a significant theme of the book.
Any thoughts about the direct descendants, the children of those people?
Yes. Well, that's the more hopeful side of it, actually, is that one of the, when I'm sort of wrapping up Generation of the Crossroads at the end and looking towards the future, one of the things that I notice is that the students who themselves grew up with it, there was a lot of bad math during the 80s where they said, these are the conservative children of the radical parents of the 60s, which would have made the radical parents of the 60s have to be about 12 years old when they had their kids. Now, in fact, their kids are hitting the colleges. Most of the curve is still in junior high school and high school, and they're a lot more involved than their peers who don't have that same experience. It's really interesting. I mean, they say things like, well, I grew up, my first demonstration, I was in a baby stroller, and there have been meetings in our house as long as I've ever can imagine, and I just see them picking up, you know, with energy and strength where their parents left off. Sometimes I remember Williams' student was saying, well, they've kind of accommodated. He runs a community garden and she works in a soup kitchen, I think it was. And I thought, this is accommodated, you know, but I'm going to pick up where they left off. And so, you know, there are varying levels of points of departure, but even the ones who backed off some, what they say is, they still taught me that speaking out was right and speaking out was important. And that, you know, and so I'm going to try and continue even if they couldn't have quite as much as they wanted. There was a great incident that happened. University of Colorado, there was a huge student environmental conference. It's a group called Student Environmental Action Coalition. That's one of the major organizations I profile in Generation at the Crossroads. And it started with two North Carolina students recycling aluminum cans to, you know, pay for their leaflets and such, started networking with other schools, got Greenpeace to run a small ad, and responses flooded, and suddenly there's 2,000 affiliates, college and high school alike. And anyway, the students, about 1,000, were on a big grass field, and a speaker suddenly says, stand up if you love the Lorax. And everybody stands up except me, and I'm thinking, now what's the Lorax? And then I remember it's this Dr. Seuss character who fights to save the trees. And just as it takes me a couple minutes to remember, because I didn't grow up in the Lorax, I was 22 by the time it was published, and this young woman says to me in this sweet voice, my mother used to read that to me when I was a little girl. And I look around at this field of everybody standing up, and I think, well, I guess everyone's mother must have read it to them because they're all standing up. And something was passed on. And I find that very heartening because that curve has not really even begun to make its major impact. But yet it presages a lot for the future.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Paul Loeb, author of Generation at the Crossroads, Apathy and Action on the American Campus. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
When I think of young people, I mean, the word that comes to my mind, one of them at least, is idealism. Mm-hmm. Is idealism still alive on college campuses?
I think it is. I mean, these are times that are hard to have hope in some ways. I mean, I think, you know, we have to be honest that the folks who have run our country into the ground seem to be in the saddle in a lot of ways, and people aren't talking about really how we're going to achieve a vision of justice as much as they have in some other times, and it's difficult. I think, though, that the students actually, a lot of them are real tenacious in their willingness to act, and they've built up networks. There's a lot more activism on campus than there was when I started lecturing in 1982. Much, much more. More social concern. Every place they go, even very conservative schools. And what happens, I think, is that they're just saying, hey, look, this is our world. Well, there's sort of two statements that really summed it up. One was the head of Student Environmental Action Coalition was saying, every generation changes the world. We're inheriting the changes of others, the toxic waste dumps, the ozone holes, the, you know, incinerators. What are we going to leave behind? So a sense of an intergenerational compact. And then the same compact expressed, there was a wonderful black student who was the head of Black Students Association at Columbia, was involved in the anti-apartheid movement there. And that was a very significant movement, because I would say that without the students' divestment actions on hundreds and hundreds of campuses, you would not have had congressional sanctions on South Africa. I think it's very clear. That was the pivotal force. And, I mean, it involved the shanties, it involved hunger strikes, it involved sit-ins, it involved referendums, it involved vast numbers of educational efforts. All of that together created this force that did really, you know, press the U.S. Congress to change its mind, and eventually, I think, played a significant role in what's going on now in South Africa. Now, this student was at Emory. He taught in Harlem for a while, and then he went back to get a doctorate at Emory in Atlanta. And he was addressing the Black Student Association. And he said, "We think we're here by because we're such good students, because this is a very prestigious school, sort of the notion of you make your own chances." He said, "We've got to remember we're literally here by the blood of our parents and grandparents. They fought to give us this opportunity. This used to be a segregated school." And he says, "You know, I realize that a lot of the changes I want may not come in my lifetime, but I know that I'm part of something that precedes me, and I'm part of something that's going to come after me, and knowing that allows me to act." And I think that's a really rooted kind of idealism. You know, it just says, it's a long haul. Yeah, it won't be easy, but we have achieved much, and we can achieve more.
My next question for you is about the anti-apartheid movement and the divestment movement. Is there anything else you want to add about that? Is there a legacy there? Is there something that will continue?
I think there is. Actually, I would say that that movement with a kind of worked at a very low level through the 70s and early 80s, and then around 85 really blossomed, that it began the shift back towards social concern. There was a real trough from 75 to 85 on the campuses. There's no question about it. I mean, people did some good things, but they were overwhelmingly isolated, and something began to shift. I think partly they were just so tired of being called callous and tired of watching stuff go by, and that, I mean, I just remember at Columbia, which really was a trigger school for so many others, they long patient work, bringing in South African expatriates to talk, workshops in the dorms, forums and educational events, and finally they did a referendum in the students' government, and a referendum that actually passed the faculty endorsement, and the trustees were stonewalling them, and the administration was stonewalling them, and then they finally decided to try a hunger strike followed a sit-in, which they figured would last a couple hours and people would be taken away and that would be that. But 300 people joined in instead of a dozen, and it lasted 3 weeks. And that lit a spark. And it just struck me that two things. One, it was really grounded in very long and patient work against the odds. But then on the other hand, it sort of proved how surprising things can be in the twists and turns of history. I remember a friend of mine, a sociologist named Dick Flax, was visiting Berkeley for SDS in 1963 in September. And everyone was bemoaning and saying, "This is a dead campus, nobody cares, nothing is happening, and we don't know how to get these students motivated." And it's like a month later, the free speech movement breaks out. And it's sometimes it's hard to anticipate those kinds of twists and turns.
I've asked you several questions about student involvement in international affairs, but the other thing that really struck me, and you've mentioned this a little bit, is this idea of community service as being either an entry level to political activism or a companion piece. What's the connection that you found between those two?
It's very complicated. I mean, I have a whole chapter on it in Generation of the Crossroads, and God, I could have probably written half a book on it, maybe a whole one. Because what happens is that a lot of times it's a way that students can avoid the perfect standard. They can avoid having to justify themselves, take a position, take a stand. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to serve soup. I'm just trying to be a big brother. I'm just trying to be part of this tutoring program. And so it allows them to avoid a lot of the stigmas and a lot of the barriers. Now, the question is, what is its relationship to social change? There was a Stanford student who had a phrase where he was talking and he said, "I've learned so much from my experience in this shelter. I just hope my grandchildren have the same experience in the same homeless shelter that I have." And, you know, he wanted to gently say, you really hope that there won't be homeless shelters. But then that story was repeated by students involved in the service movement who were saying, this is not the direction we want to go. This is not what we're about. Obviously, we want to connect at some point to be able to talk about why people come back day after day after day to the soup kitchens and shelters. And I think it's a very complicated situation where you want the service activities to be a kind of commons that anybody can enter. They don't have to be a Democrat. They don't have to be Republican. They don't have to be left, right, whatever. It is there for everyone. But you also want some moment, and I think that actually a little bit of this is beginning to happen with some of the curriculum tie-ins, where you can go back and then talk about, okay, well, why? What is welfare policy, and how did it evolve, and what is it supposed to do, and how do you get people housed, and how don't you? And you study it, you talk about it, you read books, you debate it, and it almost becomes a field work that gets you out there. And I think when that happens, that's the moment that people then start translating it into a political arena and saying, obviously, a lot of the ills we're trying to address are product of common choices, therefore de facto political choices. We have to figure out how to address them, too. It's interesting, the journey of a woman named Julia Scatliff, who was the head of COOL, which was the largest service organization for about 4 years. And she, during that period, her tenure there, she first said, well, you know, our job is just to bind up the wounds on the street, and we'll let somebody else, you know, we have all we can handle. We'll let somebody else take care of these other questions of why. And then later on, I think she just thought about it some more. She said, well, obviously, we don't want to just be a bunch of Florence Nightingales. You know, the larger systemic questions are part of it. We have to address them as well. And I think that when students really got far into it, that was their response, is that, in fact, they did begin to learn and think and to say, we have to take both. Maybe we have to meet the immediate need, but we also have to understand the roots of the crisis. Mm-hmm. And then I think the challenge for the rest of us, really, is to provide those role models essential for the students to be able to act, because that's what seems to get them involved. If a parent, if a teacher, if a community member, a clergy says, okay, yeah, these issues are hard, but we have to address them if we're going to be citizens, because otherwise they get addressed for us by default.
Well, we only have a couple of seconds left, and I just wanted to ask you one more thing here. At the end of your book, you wrote, quote, though we should be heartened by renewed student involvement, no single generation can bear the sole responsibility for healing the world. Can you give us some closing thoughts along those lines?
Well, I guess when I think about, well, why did I write Generation at the Crossroads, why did I spend 7 years on it, it's addressed to a couple constituencies. It's addressed to the students themselves to help them get past the barriers. But it's equally addressed to the rest of us, because they are inhabiting the culture that we create. And it just strikes me that if we, the rest of us, act and take the risk of speaking out as best we can and what we think is right, it's going to make it a lot easier for the students to do so. If we don't, if we maintain a silence, it's going to make it a lot harder. And so throughout the book, I don't want to put the heat on this generation. I want to explain the bind that they're caught in and then be able to say, okay, now it's up to all of us. Now it's up to all of us whether or not we're going to really treat this as a future we're passing on, this world, or whether we're going to simply say, I'm not that kind of person, and somebody else will have to take care of it.
That is Paul Loeb, and we've been discussing his most recent book, Generation at the Crossroads, Apathy and Action on the American Campus. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9511, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9511. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, you can write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by BJ Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.